It's an honor to be here. As Sabina mentioned, I am from Pittsburgh, and I did my master's down the street at Carnegie Mellon, so I'm very familiar with Pittsburgh. Very interesting to grow up here, go away to college, come back, go to graduate school, go away, come back as a professional several times, and every time I come back, you know, the city has changed so much. There are certain things that stay the same. So it's always interesting to analyze Pittsburgh. Most of my research looks at, the broad question that I look at is macroeconomic change and how that influences urban labor markets and urban populations. I'm particularly interested in workforce development. So I do a lot of work on workforce development policy and the connection between workforce development and economic development. What does that have to do with entrepreneurship? I kind of got into entrepreneurship through my interest in workforce development. I wrote an article a couple years ago about connecting workforce development and economic development. I also wrote an article about why we aren't using more entrepreneurship as a workforce development tool. And then I got more and more interested in entrepreneurship, so that's how I ended up doing this. The work that I'm presenting today is, as Sabina mentioned, funded by the Kauffman Foundation. And during that grant, I did a comparative study of entrepreneurial ecosystems in Pittsburgh, Richmond, and Chicago, and I'll get more into that in a minute. So there has been a lot of energy and excitement around entrepreneurship over the last several years. It's always been a part of economic development, but kind of the intersections between entrepreneurship and some of these new developments, such as the gig economy and those other sorts of things, and now our focus on the ecosystem and connections, more so than individual entrepreneurs, has given new excitement to entrepreneurship. My interest in entrepreneurship as an economic development scholar is really about its ability to create jobs and alleviate poverty. Some of the discussion around entrepreneurship, a lot of the discussion is about the importance of networks and connections. The level of connections is important not just for individual entrepreneurs, but also those networks are important for the organizations that assist entrepreneurs. And while most research on entrepreneurship focuses on individual entrepreneurs, my research focuses on entrepreneurial assisting organizations. And those are the organizations that, as part of their charge, assist entrepreneurs with opening businesses and with success. There are three trends that have been happening in entrepreneurship that are relevant to this work. One of them is that entrepreneurship and innovation have become increasingly concentrated geographically, meaning that there are implications for access to both the resources and to the entrepreneurs and their new businesses. Another trend that I think is impacting urban areas and disadvantaged populations is the increased focus and on high growth firms and technology firms, sometimes to the exclusion of everything else. And this matters because there's lots of inequality within the field of entrepreneurship. There's lots of pieces written about it. I'm sure you all have heard about inequality in entrepreneurship as it relates to women, as it relates to minorities, as it relates to low-income folks. And so one of the questions that I had is, all of these trends that are happening in entrepreneurship, what do they mean for inequality? We've become very excited about entrepreneurial ecosystems. That's a relatively new term. We've been only using it commonly for about, I want to say 10 years, if that. About 4 years ago, the Kauffman Foundation wanted to have more research on ecosystems specifically. So they funded, I would say, somewhere between 12 and 15 scholars around the country to look at different aspects of entrepreneurial ecosystems. However, little, and so lots of that research is coming out now in the journals, but little has been written about inequality as it relates to the ecosystem approach and physical and social manifestations of ecosystems within urban environment. And so I wanted to look at that as part of my research. So before we start, let's just define ecosystems. I think of it as, and this is Mason and Brown's definition, a set of interconnected entrepreneurial actors, organizations, and institutions which formally and informally coalesce, connect, mediate, and govern the performance of local entrepreneurial environments. So the support systems that govern and legitimate and create entrepreneurial ecosystems. The main emphasis in the ecosystems kind of literature is on connectivity between actors and institutions in a way that's organic and leads to the sharing of knowledge that leads to innovation. So how the ecosystem kind of thinking differs from just studying individual entrepreneurs and their businesses is that it focuses on the connections and the implications of those. So my main question is, are entrepreneurial ecosystems exacerbating inequality? And I try to look at this in through several sub-questions. One of the questions I had was, do minority and poor communities have access to the entrepreneurial assistance that is out there? One, how does entrepreneurial capacity differ between organizations serving underrepresented communities compared to those that are not? Three, what are the implications of overemphasis on scalability and technology? And four, what are the implications of structure, partnership, and leadership and access in terms of reproducing inequality? And I want to back up for a minute and say, I don't know if any of you noticed that in my title slide, I'm sure you all read that, it said three instead of four. I originally said four and then decided to only present three today because this research is based on a pilot study that I did in Detroit. And that's kind of where these questions came from. I did a pilot study in Detroit a few years ago. There were lots of articles in New York Times, Washington Post coming out talking about Detroit, right after Detroit had experienced bankruptcy. And they were saying Detroit's going to bring itself back through entrepreneurship. There are so many reasons for entrepreneurship in Detroit. And it's is it the next Tribeca? And it was very exciting. And I said, really? Let me go see. And so I went to Detroit. I got a grant from University of Michigan Business School to go look at entrepreneurship in Detroit and what the resources are and that sort of thing. And through that study, I kind of started to understand, and this is before ecosystem kind of language was being used, that it's who gets the resources is really about the connections. So in that study, I did one, the pilot study was very similar to what I did in Chicago, Richmond, and Pittsburgh. But once I did the Detroit study, I said I really need to do a broader study on connections. So let's talk about my study. So what I did for this study is I built an original database in each of my case study places, Chicago, Richmond, and Pittsburgh. I wanted to know what all of the organizations were that assist entrepreneurs in each place, but a good list didn't exist. So I had to build my own database. I basically went to the internet, trolled the internet. I should be honest, I didn't, my research assistants did. They went to the internet, they trolled the internet, they found every organization that said they assist entrepreneurs in each of these places, and they checked those lists with local stakeholders in entrepreneurship to make sure that they were good. If there was a list that already existed, we started with that, verified it, went from there. The other thing we did in this research was interviews. I did 150 interviews, yes, I did those all myself, 50 in each place with key stakeholders in entrepreneurship. They were semi-structured, about an hour long and confidential. I asked them about their entrepreneurial ecosystem, their organization. I wanted to get more of a local feel for how the entrepreneurial ecosystem was functioning. I also included like local government, economic development folks in those interviews. I transcribed them all verbatim and coded them using Deduce software. The final thing that I did is with my original database of organizations in each place, I did a survey of the organizations, basically wanting to collect quantitative information, asking them things like, which populations do you serve? Do you have minimum numbers in terms of dollars, per year revenues, employees, that sort of thing? What do you focus on in terms of the entrepreneurs that you assist? Do you target women, minorities? What's your service area? All of those sorts of things. So I did a survey too. So the last thing I did is I married some of that data to census data. So a lot of data. So the first thing I talked about was, so the questions, the research questions, kind of came from that Detroit study, but then also, this wasn't the paper I intended to write. I didn't intend to address inequality in this study in such a direct way, but after I did 150 interviews, I saw a lot of patterns that were emerging. As you could imagine, in each of these places, to do 50 interviews, you get to travel all over the city, you're getting to go to these places, and the first thing I noticed is I wasn't traveling as far as I thought I would be traveling. A lot of the places that assist entrepreneurs tended to be clustered in particular parts of the city. So I wondered if there was an access issue there. So one of the things that I did is I geocoded each of the addresses of the organizations in my database, and I overlaid that with poverty and race. And what you're looking at now is a map of Chicago. And the first, the yellow map is poverty, and the blue map is race. So what you'll notice is that there is a clustering of the entrepreneurial assisting organizations here, and while there are some spread out, the majority of them tend to be clustered in the same geographic area. And that is important because although you can say people can take a bus, they can walk, lots of the literature has shown that geographic proximity matters, especially for poor populations that often don't have the same access to transportation as other folks. So.
It's in a loop too, right?
Yeah. That's where it is. Well, and Chicago's kind of special because they have this monstrosity called 1871. Anybody familiar with 1871? It's a huge, I don't even know what to call it. They call it a hub. Within this building, there are nine separate incubators. Every university is there. It just has. When I walked in, I was kind of overwhelmed. I had to sit down and catch my breath. There's so much activity going on. There's so much of what is entrepreneurship in Chicago is in 1871. It's really fascinating to see. If you're ever in Chicago, go visit. So that's located somewhere there. And you see that if you overlay with race, in this map, it shows that the dark tracks are the tracks that are more than 50% combined African-American and Hispanic, so more than 50% minority. So there's a lack of access both in terms of people in poverty and minorities. So this is Pittsburgh, same kind of maps with poverty and with race. And although Pittsburgh doesn't have nearly as many minorities as a place like Chicago, you still see the clustering effect in Pittsburgh, and you still see that the most impoverished neighborhoods are less likely to have an entrepreneurial assisting organization within 2 miles than census tracts that aren't in poverty. So that's not shown here, but that's shown through my statistical analysis. I drew a circle around each census tract and counted how many entrepreneurial assisting organizations were within 1.5 miles, which is considered to be walking distance. And there's a significant difference between those that are census tracts that are high poverty and not, and those that are concentrated with minority populations and not. And then there's Richmond. Again, you see the clustering effect. And in case you're wondering what these little stars are on the outside, in each place there were some organizations that weren't in the city but said that they primarily service entrepreneurs in the city. So they're not, they're on the map but not in the analysis. So I think access is an issue that needs to be discussed in more detail, and we can talk about that. Not only physical access or geographic access, but if you are in the community, there's another level of access. And I'll just use an example from Pittsburgh, since all my interviews were confidential, I won't say who it was. But I was at an entrepreneurial assisting organization in Pittsburgh, and they were in the hood. And I was like, kudos for you. And we're in the region. We purposely located where the poor people are, blah, 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 blah. And what I noticed, I got there a little early, 15 minutes before my appointment, about 8:15, and I sat and watched. And everybody who worked there, every entrepreneur that was being served, got out of the car, parked very close, got out of the car, walked directly in the building. It's interesting doing this research in Pittsburgh, because every place I went, I was the only African American. And I watch all of this, and then I go into the place. They were very proud that they located in the hood. Yes, we try to be a beacon, da da da. And I said, well, how many minority entrepreneurs do you actually serve? And they were like, oh, we don't really keep track of that, and blah, blah, blah. And then they said, the guy down the street that cuts hair, he came in here and to see our facility, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, that's great. Did you give him any services? And they were like, no, that's not really what we do, but, you know, we're open to people seeing our... So anyway, so just being there is not enough either. So that was my interesting experience in Pittsburgh, and I'll tell you one more story about Pittsburgh. The people in Pittsburgh told me, okay, so we have this get-together on Fridays. All the entrepreneurial people come, have coffee, chit-chat, whatever. And I was like, oh, great, I'm going to come. And the guy stopped, and he said, I'm going to tell you something. Every week, there are two African-Americans, and everybody knows who they are consistently. Those two are the only ones that come. So if you come and there's a third one, everybody's going to stop and be like, whoa, who's she? So I had to come. You know I had to go. So I show up, and just like he predicted, I walk in, and everybody stopped. It was like, and, you know, I straighten my jacket and walk in, and people kept coming up to me. Oh, hi, how are you? Who are you? What are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. Everybody wanted to know basically what I was doing there. So the culture in Pittsburgh is interesting and true to what they thought about it. I also wanted to point out, so I wanted to know whether there was a correlation between percent Black, percent Hispanic, percent in poverty, and the number of entrepreneurial assisting organizations in an area. And you can see that there is a significant correlation between percent Spanish or Hispanic or Latina, Latinx, whatever the politically correct term is, this town, and the number. The one for percent African American is not quite statistically significant. It's significant at 7.8%, but very close. So the relationship seen on the maps is statistically significant. So another factor that I looked at in my survey is how many organizations that are serving entrepreneurs are actually targeting underrepresented populations, are purposely serving those populations. And here we have the results from the survey. You can see that the numbers are pretty low. The underrepresented group that gets targeted the most is women, followed by low income. But of the three areas, Chicago targets the least, and that will come into play later in terms of culture in Chicago's entrepreneurial ecosystem.
Can you go back to that just a second? They target, okay.
The percent of survey respondents that said they target these groups for their entrepreneurial services. The other thing that kept coming up in the survey is the relationship between who's funding entrepreneurship and their relationship with vulnerable populations. So I asked the question about what percent of your funding comes from these various sources. And I asked about public funds, federal, state, local, private funds, foundations, and others. What you can see on this slide is that across the board, for all three areas, the majority of funds come from private sources. Beyond the private sources, for each city it's different. The second greatest proportion in Richmond comes from public funds. The second greatest proportion in Pittsburgh comes from foundations. And the second greatest in Chicago comes from other sources not listed. Not sure what that is, but it's a pretty significant percent in Chicago. And the reason that matters is there is a relationship between the percentage of funds that are coming from private sources and whether you are serving underserved and disadvantaged communities. I should stop and say I created an index which looked at the number of vulnerable groups that a particular organization was serving, and that's what you see there as the target vulnerable population score. And there is a relationship, a statistically significant relationship, between the extent to which you serve vulnerable populations and the percentage of your money that is coming from private funds. So the greater percentage of your money that's coming from private funds, the lower your score on serving vulnerable populations. And the opposite is true for the percentage coming from public funds. As you see that 50%, I don't know why I didn't circle that. So all of that is to say there's an access issue. The second issue I looked at in my study, boy, time is going by really fast. In my study, for the interviews, I created an icebreaker question. And the icebreaker question was, whenever you start an interview, you want to put your interviewee at ease and make a connection with them, let them talk about themselves, because that always makes them feel better. So my icebreaker question was, tell me about yourself. Tell me about your journey to this point. How did you come to be running this entrepreneurial assisting organization? And it was meant to be an icebreaker. Some people went on and on and on. Other people gave me a quick snippet. But I started to notice a pattern. I started to notice that the organizations that were serving, that were not serving vulnerable populations and were technology focused primarily, the folks would say, I have an MBA, I've run three companies, I'm a former entrepreneur, and this such and such, that kind of background, MBA or degree in entrepreneurship, I've run companies, I've been an advisor, that sort of thing. But then I started to notice that some of the organizations that I went to who primarily serve disadvantaged populations, the backgrounds were very different. A lot of them just fell into it. A lot of them, I was tired of corporate America. My cousin knew a person who worked in blah, 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 and I got this job. One guy, I was traveling around Costa Rica trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life, and I got this job. So I started to wonder about capacity, because having that entrepreneurial training and background is really important for your ability to guide an organization that is going to assist entrepreneurs. And so just to give you a few mainstream and tech-based organizations, these are direct quotes from my interviews. And you'll see things like business These are the Main Street business consultant for 9 years, got an MBA, and was involved in entrepreneurial law. I've created some number of businesses, launched a nonprofit 19 years ago. Another one has various entrepreneurial ventures, 20 plus years of entrepreneurial experience. Now compare those to some of the typical ones for administrators running organizations serving underrepresented groups. I have a background in public administration. It kind of worked out to where I got this job. Or I was an elementary school teacher in the Chicago Public Schools. Another one, I had no interest in business and was a high school math teacher. Another one, I worked for a small construction firm. I had experience in construction management, and I had the opportunity to step into a role of program manager, and so I did it. So there are lots of implications of that. Not just if you are guiding entrepreneurs and you don't have that background yourself, then there's a disadvantage there, but also your networks. And entrepreneurship networks are so important. So if you have that background, you've gone to school, you have that training, and or if you've run a business, you have networks in entrepreneurship which you can link the people and the businesses that you're trying to help to. So those are there. I think that is that capacity is an issue. The third thing that I noticed was an overemphasis on technology and scalability. And I know that both of these are important, but I think that currently in entrepreneurial ecosystems, they are valued to the exclusion of everything else. And I wanted so desperately to write an article called Obsession with the Big and Sexy, because I just liked that title. The big being scalability and the sexy being technology. So anything with technology in it was, ooh, people's eyes would light up. If you said you were going to be the next Google, Amazon, eyes would light up. If you say, I want to start a restaurant, this is not where you should be. So Thomas Lyons wrote an article in 2015, and he basically said everything I wanted to say, but he didn't do research. It was an essay. So he talks about too much attention being focused on scalability and technology. One of the questions in the survey asked, do you focus on businesses with technology, that are involved with technology? And they said yes or no. So I did some analysis of those organizations versus others. About 36% of the survey participants said they focus on technology. However, based on interviews, I think the number was much higher. Some of the organizations didn't answer that question. I'm not sure why, but the ones that didn't answer it looked very much like the ones that checked they focus on technology. When I looked at technology focused versus non, the technology focused helped far fewer entrepreneurs per year. The average was 65 versus 154 with the other organization. Also, the technology focus were less likely to target underrepresented populations and communities. Technology, and that goes along with technology focused, were to a great extent funded by private firms. And it wasn't just other organizations that prioritized technology. It was also funders, not-for-profit, and government that preferred scalability and technology. So one thing that I was concerned about is that the technology-focused seemed very exclusive. So here are some quotes on what they focus on and what they look for in terms of businesses to help, words like innovative, high-growth companies, as opposed to professional service entities and Main Street businesses. So Main Street and lifestyle always seemed like a put-down, like they were marginalizing those businesses. Another one, when we I won't read the whole quote, but when we run into those kind of businesses, the third one, we send them to some people who might be interested in that. So I think that there is just kind of this exclusive culture, which primarily tech-focused and organizations funded by private funds are focused on. And given that in the entrepreneurial ecosystem, most organizations prioritize tech, this excludes a whole lot of people, a whole lot of businesses. The other thing that I think is very important, and this is part of another paper, but it comes together with this. So another thing that I actually started all this research out being interested in partnerships and how organizations are partnering with each other and what incentivizes organizations to partner with each other. And that is very important because that's how information and resources flow through the system. I used to teach at the University of Michigan. So I have a lot of former students who are now in Detroit running economic development organizations. And several of them are running entrepreneurial-related economic development organizations. And one of my visits to Detroit, and one day I went to interview two of my students. The first student, she was leading one of the top community development corporations in Detroit, very focused on entrepreneurship, and she was telling me about this grant that she was getting ready to apply for. She's very excited about it. It was a big grant, and I was like, wow, that's great. And I said, well, how do you learn about the resources? How did you learn about this? And she said, well, I was at the meeting. I was like, well, she said the meeting where all the people who are interested in this grant were at. And I said, well, how did you know about the meeting? How did you get invited to the meeting? And she said, I was on the list. And I was like, oh, so there's a list that goes out to the people. And I said, well, how did you get on the list? And she said, such and so put me on the list, and so I got invited to the meeting. And the meeting was very important because it went in detail on how to apply for this grant, you know, their priorities, what they're looking for, gave some tips, that sort of thing. So I was like, okay, that's great. Good luck. So I went to visit another student who was running an even bigger economic development organization. And I said, are you applying for this particular grant? And she says, oh, I just saw that announcement today. I don't know anything about it. And I said, well, why weren't you at the meeting? I didn't know about the meeting. And so then I called the other student and I said, was she on the list? And she says, no, she's not on the list. And so I thought, wow, this is really interesting because this limits their ability to garner resources, just not being on the list, you don't get the information. So at the organizational level, if your organization is not tied into the network, then you're missing all of those resources. I said all that to say that this network piece is very important and who you are connected to, and therefore, if you are a node that gets the information through the network has a huge influence on your ability to help the entrepreneurs on your roster. Okay. So I have an article coming out in Economic Development Quarterly, I think it's coming out in February, on partnership and leadership in entrepreneurial ecosystems. And I haven't talked much about the comparative part, but in that article I really compare partnership in Richmond, Pittsburgh, and Chicago, and interestingly, in Pittsburgh, they're the most collaborative among the three. You might not be surprised with that. I affectionately call Pittsburgh the get-along town. One of the things that, when I was asking about collaboration in Pittsburgh, my favorite quote is, at least three people said this, we play nice in the sandbox together here. And the message was consistent in Pittsburgh, that there's a lot of collaboration. And I came up with these three models of how collaboration and leadership works in Pittsburgh, Richmond, and Chicago. In Chicago, people tend to collaborate and partner in clusters. So all the tech people collaborate together. All of the makerspace people tend to collaborate. There's some overlap, of course. And all of the people who are kind of on the outside have their own little cluster. And each of those cluster has lead entrepreneurial assisting organizations that are kind of serving as the guidance for that. In Pittsburgh, most of the organizations tend to collaborate together. There's more cross, and there are some very clear leaders. Another question that I asked in my interviews is, who are the leaders of this ecosystem? And in Pittsburgh, people were in agreement. There were some very clear leaders, but there were a few organizations left on the outside and didn't feel like they were a part of this. What happened? What happened?
The smart board zoomed in.
Oh, yeah, when you
Oh.
Try, yeah, it's real active.
No?
I think if you had a key on the keyboard, it will go back.
Which one?
Any one, I think.
And so in Richmond, Richmond is a fledgling ecosystem. They're just getting started. So Richmond was very interesting. When I said, who's leading the entrepreneurial ecosystem here, everybody said, me. It's me, I am. And I wanted to say, nobody agrees with you, but okay. So there isn't much collaboration in Richmond. If you know anything about Richmond, it's the South. They're stuck in their ways. They're kind of late to the game in terms of entrepreneurial ecosystems. So one of my favorite quotes from Richmond was, it's like the Wild Wild West out here. Everybody's, you know, there are no signs of where to go or what to do, and everybody's kind of doing their own thing. So that's Richmond. The thing I wanted to point out, the reason I put this in this presentation, is that I wanted to point out that in each of these systems, there's exclusion, but the model is a little different for each of them. In Chicago, the organizations left on the outside are kind of in their own little group, and in their words, they get crumbs, but they try to collaborate with each other. In Pittsburgh, there were a few organizations that felt left out, but they felt like they were out there on their own. They didn't really have a group. And in Richmond, everybody's on their own. They're in a little silo trying to make it. So the patterns of exclusion come in many forms. In the same article where I'm talking about leadership, I argue that it seems like the lead entrepreneurial assisting organizations, those who have been identified as the leaders, they set the tone and the culture. They set the rules, the institutions, and the norms that impact. There's something missing on this slide. Here it is. Yeah. That impact how different organizations interact with each other, and the extent what values influence that interaction. So the lead organizations become very instrumental in whether in the level of exclusion or whether it's going to be an inclusive ecosystem. So what matters for entrepreneurial inequality? One, access to resources and information matters. The ability to know, for example, for the second student to not have information that the grant process was happening and how to be successful in that. That matters for her entrepreneurs, whether she gets those resources. Targeting disadvantaged and other represented populations matters in terms of their likelihood of participating. The fact that there is so much inequality in entrepreneurship for women and minorities, part of the reason for that is that they haven't been targeted. There haven't been specific resources. There haven't been programs tailored toward what they need. The ecosystem has prioritized technology and scalability, which those programs don't necessarily meet the needs of these groups. Funders and their priorities matter. One of the things I heard in Pittsburgh, which is different from the other places, is that what the foundations say is what we do. So one particular organization that I went to, he said, to be honest, I said, so what, this is the same person who was in the community and very proud of himself, and I said, so what do you do for the community? He said, to be honest, at first I wasn't involved at all, and then the foundations made it clear that they wanted more of a community focus, and they wanted more community engagement, so I had to become more outward facing to make that happen, because that was their priority for their money. So what the funders want and what their priorities are definitely matter. In Richmond, there aren't that many foundations, so what the private money wants matters. Capacity and social capital of entrepreneurial champions, I'm calling them here, matters. So those administrators running the organizations, and I talked about that, leadership and partnership matter. The leadership setting the tone, the culture, those sorts of things matter for whether other organizations within that place are going to see that as the norm and see that as a value. Operating ecosystems from a perspective of inclusions rather than exclusion also matters for inequality. Final slide, I think, with the implications of this. The implications are that we need to reframe our thinking about ecosystems as exclusive clubs or belonging to those in technology and highly scalable businesses to more inclusive ideas such as community wealth building. We need to think of our ecosystems as wealth building for the entire population, not just this segment of the population. I was at a conference last week on business incubation, and I gave my presentation. I gave this presentation a little bit different, but the guy who got up and did his presentation after me, he defined entrepreneurial ecosystems as only consisting of businesses that are involved with technology and are highly scalable. So that just confirmed to me that in terms of thinking of this, there are lots of folks out there that are very exclusive, very explicitly exclusive in that way. The other implication is that leadership is critical to thinking around partnerships and culture. Ecosystem leaders need to be more intentional about the messaging in terms of what we value, but also the investment, where the investment goes. So systems-oriented thinking is needed to better focus entrepreneurship on broader economic development goals. One of the things that was different about Pittsburgh than the other three places that I've been, if you go back to this slide, the reason that Pittsburgh looks like this, most of the organizations that I visited in Pittsburgh talked about the whole system. They were not just concerned about what they would do, they were concerned about how what they would do would impact the ecosystem in general. And there were many examples of when they were going to start something new, how did that fit into the system? What need did that focus on in the system? Whereas other places, it was more, how is this going to influence maker spaces, or how is this going to influence me? Pittsburgh entrepreneurial assisting organizations were systems oriented. So they're the closest to, and I'm not just saying that because I'm in Pittsburgh. they are the closest. And Sabina, you've written about the culture in Pittsburgh, the collaborative culture. I found that in ecosystems as well. So that's my presentation. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
Look forward to questions.
Let's open it up for questions. And any comments and questions from all of you? Anybody ready to start? Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
That was great. That was really interesting.
Thank you.
One of my clarifying questions that I had is, when you say private funders that are not foundations, can you give a couple of examples of those?
Well, I didn't ask for examples. That was just a question on the survey. So individuals, could be individuals that are funding. It could be, well.
Like family members too? Or?
It could be when I say individuals, family members. It could be organizations that are private money. So anybody who's not, and I had to differentiate it from foundations, particularly for Pittsburgh, because I think the foundations play a unique role here,
okay,
especially in entrepreneurship and economic development. Yes?
I'm Jen Petrie, and I'm a postdoc at the David Berg Center for Ethics and Leadership, mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of outsider here, but I loved your presentation.
Thank you.
Really hit on issues of corporate social responsibility, what's being left out,
mm-hmm.
entrepreneurship. It was really insightful.
Thank you.
I had a question about the data, and I'm really intrigued by how many interviews and the extent of your research that went into this. And I know you mentioned they do software,
mm-hmm.
so if you could explain a little bit more about how you did that. I know that's a software program.
So
was it manual, or was it... You know.
Yes. What?
Well,
after this,
that, I mean, this is a huge accomplishment.
Thank you.
All the
I don't think I thought through the fact that I was going to do all 150 interviews myself. And I said that, and they gave me the money, and then I was like, oh yeah, now I got to do this. But in the end, it ended up being beneficial, because I didn't have to rely on anybody else's translation. I had heard every bit of the information myself, so that was good. And deduce, and so I had each of the, I recorded, like on one of these, and I had each of the interviews transcribed. And then in deduce, you can identify themes and then tag parts of the text that apply to that theme, and then you can export all those tags.
Mm-hmm.
And write from that. So that's essentially what I did. First thing I did, so the other advantage of doing all the interviews myself, I was getting the story as it was going along. So after after every interview, I'd take 5 or 10 minutes in my car or on a park bench or wherever and write out some thoughts. This is how this connects to this, I think. And then when I got into deduce, I would take those themes and kind of look through the interviews to see if I found evidence of that. And so I love deduce. This project was my first time using it, so there was a learning curve. And I have to say, I coded a great deal, but I had to pull my husband in on this one. he has no experience in any of this. He's a corporate guy. He has a degree in public policy. I was like, that's good enough. You can help. And he actually saw some things that I didn't see. But yeah, I coded one by one for each theme and then exported it to Excel by theme to see what I found.
Okay.
Yes, you've been here. Hi.
The economic development piece. A lot of the entrepreneurs are generational, family-owned businesses that you made reference to. The gentleman that came from the barbershop that could possibly have been the second generation, he was turned off
mm-hmm.
by not being representative of who was actually attending these.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in an area that's exploding like Pittsburgh and you have gentrification, unseating stakeholders and entrepreneurs were the founder of the business may have done it by sweat and brow,
mm-hmm.
sent his children to school and they come back as doctors and lawyers and accountants, that are in the position to take that small business to the next level, and they now have been educated to the point where they could scale up,
mm-hmm.
but they're turned off and they're unseated because all of a sudden their rent is tripling and the son that he prepared to inherit this business goes away.
Right.
And I find that's a big problem in Pittsburgh, is up until recently, with all the publicity, our young people were leaving the city and
yeah.
starting their entrepreneurial efforts and scalability outside of their hometown.
And that's a problem everywhere. That's a problem everywhere. But in Pittsburgh, I agree. I don't want to say my notion of Pittsburgh is romantic, but when I lived here, we had like neighborhoods, and we had a lot of neighborhood restaurants and businesses. and you didn't know them unless you were from here. My husband came here for graduate school, and he's like, oh, let me take you to this place. No, sweetie, let me take you to this place. He's like, wow, this is so much better. I would have never known about this. So Pittsburgh has a history of entrepreneurship, a history of mom and pop shops that really mean something to the community. And you're right, I see a lot of that going away. What I heard a lot in Pittsburgh, because of this focus on technology, was that people start businesses and then they take them to the West Coast because there are a number of problems here with the funding, that sort of thing. And also, I heard a lot that there's only one flight in from the West Coast every day and one flight out. So if you're in a technology-oriented business, it's hard to coordinate with people on the West Coast. So there are lots of issues that make it less than ideal. And so that is a problem with people starting businesses, using the resources, and then leaving to go to other places. Yes.
So first off, I wanted to say I lived in Richmond for a couple of years,
okay.
And it is like that. My question, though, is, one, how did these ecosystems get established, especially like Chicago, where it's very fragmented?
Mm-hmm.
And then as a leader of that area, how would you go about changing the culture?
So the culture of entrepreneurship in Chicago, like in Pittsburgh, is very similar to the broader culture of Chicago. So when I showed Chicago and each one of those little clusters had a leader, this was very unstable because several people told me, this is the leader now, but I plan to be a leader in the future. It's very competitive and cutthroat. Definitely, we don't want these silos. We want people to be interacting across. But I think that one of the issues in Pittsburgh, I call it the get-along town, is that sometimes that competition leads to greater innovation. So you don't want to be locked into one way of thinking and everybody is kind of on the same page. You want them to be on the same page. The good things about Pittsburgh is there's a unified vision of where they want to go, but you also want there to be disruptors. You want people to be come in with new ideas and not just go along with the plan. So while in Chicago, I think we need to break down these walls, I think kind of the competitive nature is a good thing. We could use a little more of that here. I don't know how you break down the walls. One potential action is for the public sector to get more involved in entrepreneurship than they are, because that seems to be the only way to target, or the most effective way to target minority entrepreneurs and disadvantaged entrepreneurs, because the public sector can push that. I know in Pittsburgh, you all are doing some things that you weren't doing when I did this research a couple years ago. There are some new initiatives going on here. But in Chicago, the public sector, the mayor's office, they are as obsessed with technology and scalability as anybody else. So that makes it hard there. Yes?
Question about being able to distinguish different types of entrepreneurship in different fields.
Mm-hmm.
So, especially the division between technology-led or technology-based entrepreneurship,
mm-hmm.
and as was talked about earlier, the more basic, more
mm-hmm.
accessible forms of entrepreneurship,
mm-hmm.
or small businesses, it's actually work skills. Because I think it's a very big division, and
mm-hmm.
I would be interested, I guess, in knowing kind of how that plays out spatially in the maps that you showed earlier, and then also kind of whether or not you think it is still useful to talk about entrepreneurship as one idea when there are very specific outcomes and systems for technology-based entrepreneurship more small scale, not necessarily profit-driven or massive profit-driven entrepreneurship.
Okay, so in terms of when I'm dividing tech and non-tech, that is determined by the survey participants. Do you focus on technology-based businesses or not? That's a yes or no question for them. So that's how I divide it. Because we are talking about an ecosystem, I think in any ecosystem there's a spectrum and they feed off of each other. And I don't think that they need to be separate. I think there needs to be an acknowledgement that they can be different and have different needs, and but still operate within the same system. Because those mom and pop, lifestyle, whatever you want to call them, those businesses are important not just for creating self-sufficiency for those individuals and creating community-based jobs, but also they're an important part of the economy as well. They play a role in making the other highly scalable businesses possible. So I think what we need to figure out is what is the advantage and what are the relationships between those businesses and, you know, the highly scalable and technology-based businesses, as opposed to just saying it's all one thing or it's all another or they're completely separate. We need to figure out that relationship and honor that relationship and feed that relationship, as opposed to just ignoring the role and the important the role of those smaller businesses in the ecosystem. Yes?
I'm going to take that a little bit different direction, because your funder, Kauffman Foundation, we think of innovation-based industries and locally serving ones, or Main Street. So the Kauffman Foundation in Kansas City puts out a rating of entrepreneurship for American metro areas every year. And the Pittsburgh metro area ends up being 40th out of 40th. And that would be on the entrepreneur, on the technology side, or what they call innovation-based industries. Catalyst Connection, who's out to promote technology firms and technology entrepreneurship, was a little peeved. So when Yaz My Toy was there, they had Yaz in. And Kauffman also does a Main Street entrepreneurship ranking, where Pittsburgh ranks much higher up, like, you know, fifth or sixth in the country, as opposed to 40th out of 40. Did any of that come through when you were doing your interviews, or that knowledge, and then, you know, taking that back to your point, your question there on the tech side, Pittsburgh hasn't been successful for decades.
Well, it depends on how you define success. Yes, people were very pissed at that 40 out of 40 ranking, which I was shocked at. In my other paper on leadership and partnership, you'll see that Pittsburgh ranks higher than Chicago in 2 out of 3 of the Kauffman indicators. So I find that interesting. A big thing that hurt Pittsburgh in that ranking was they considered, they asked the entrepreneurs whether they were employed before they started their business. And if they weren't, they considered their business a needs something that you just started business because you weren't employed. It wasn't based on high growth or something. And that was a huge thing in Pittsburgh, which I don't buy that. I don't buy that everybody who wasn't employed before they started a business only started necessity. That's what they called them, necessity entrepreneurs. But even if you are a necessity entrepreneur.
What about those two Stanford guys, like 40 years ago?
Exactly. So I honestly don't tell them because they gave me money. But I think there are some serious problems with their rankings and how they rank them. And in the article that's coming out, I show a lot of different measures for each one, and I show that Pittsburgh is ranked higher than Chicago in 2 out of 3, which is, but they're 40th. That doesn't make any sense to me. I really, even in being here, it's so much more together, but it's Pittsburgh. People on the outside have a misconception of what Pittsburgh is like and what's here and that sort of thing, and it's not unless you actually come see or you know Pittsburgh, that you know that. And so I think Pittsburgh suffers from a reputation problem more than anything. People say, oh, you're from Pittsburgh, Steel Town. I'm like, that was so long ago. Other questions?
More questions?
Right. Yes. You're right behind each other, so I looked in that direction.
Did you notice the similar characteristics of the leaders compared to the organizations in the city? So were the leaders still tending to be, you know, not serving underserved as much, not concentrating on women, or were there any exceptions?
I think that, and that's why I made this diagram, I think that the leadership in each place was very different. I think that in Pittsburgh, the leadership was very focused on the entire system and making sure all needs were met. Even though there are still some issues, they were always thinking about, as a city or as a region, where are we going, what do we need, that sort of thing. So that's what I got from a lot of the organizations that were identified as by others as leaders here, is that they were system thinking. And they were less about competition with other organizations and more about, okay, you're doing that, let me do this piece, or I should do this piece now. Or, and they talked about where they were going in the future. There seemed to be like some agreement between the leaders and the other organizations on where they were going, and the leaders seemed to be trying to take it there. In Chicago, on the other hand, organizations that were identified as leaders were identified as leaders for their dominance and for their being seen as cutting edge. It wasn't because you're leading us all, it's that you're a leader in a competitive sense. And they were constantly trying to get ahead themselves. But those are the values that are put forth, and those are the values that hold in Chicago. So everybody was okay with that. You know, that's how we roll. We compete. So the leaders are competing, and those are our rules and our norms. And yeah, I told you Richmond didn't really have any, so. Yes, oh wait.
I was just wondering, you know, CRM, you know, just took over everything.
What's CRM?
The customer relation, data managing, trying
okay.
to find out, getting to the head, buying powers of management, things of that nature. So they're doing a lot of data driven to say what kind of water I'm going to drink. When you have community-based jobs, where you have customer loyalty, their destination businesses, they know what's going on in families, churches, and schools, you would think that the leaders would value that even more, because
mm-hmm.
if you said you had a greater outcome because you did all of the 150 interviews,
mm-hmm.
you were able to tag it based on your filter,
mm-hmm.
on six different people's filters. How do we turn it upside down? How can we go back and subset the word or the connotation and the perspective of entrepreneurship, that there should be tiers and there should be more greater focus? Because how can you keep trying to build a community and all you're doing is breaking apart and bringing in national-based restaurants as opposed to the little bakery or the pizza shop that's been there for decades, centuries?
One of the things that I've noticed in Pittsburgh is that when Pittsburgh decided to become Eds and Meds versus Steel, I mean, and that was a decision. One thing I like about Pittsburgh, I tell them, Pittsburgh is a plan town. They make a plan and they go for it. It might be a bad plan, it might be a good plan, but they always have a plan. Is that one thing that I've noticed for Pittsburgh is when they decided to change their economy, they brought a lot of transplants in. So when you decide to, I teach economic development. When you decide which direction you're going to go in, another sub-decision is, are we building an economy for the people that are here, or are we building an economy for the people that we want to be here? And Pittsburgh built an economy for the people they wanted to be here. And so part of that is that what I've noticed now is a lot of people in powerful positions that don't have a real appreciation for Pittsburgh itself. They don't have kind of that historic context, or you might call it baggage, but they don't have an appreciation for all of those things that you're talking about, all the things that make Pittsburgh special. So they're making decisions just based on some other criteria and not really able to appreciate at that micro level. So I think that's part of the issue. Some of the people that I didn't always disclose that I was from Pittsburgh, and some of the people that I talked to were telling me about Pittsburgh, and their perception of it was so wrong and off. And I just smiled politely and pretended like I was taking notes, but I audio taped every interview, so But I was just like, no, that's just not, that's wrong. If you came to Pittsburgh and you went to the south side right now, you would have a totally different impression of it and what that neighborhood is about than if you went there 10 years ago. I don't know how long it's been developed. I can't quite remember when the Cheesecake Factory came, but
the LTV site. Yeah.
Yeah, but it was very different. So, and a lot of the people still live in that neighborhood. So not understanding that when you're planning for that neighborhood, you're planning for the people who are on East Carson. You're not planning for the people that live one street over and two streets back, because you don't even see them. So the transplants, there's a lot of transplants here guiding the economy. And so I think they need to have more neighborhood groups. People have been for decades. My family lives here. Some of them have lived in the same house for four decades. So, you know, they have a different perception of their community and what it needs. I mean, I still go to the same pizza shops when I come here. I'm like, where is it? Is it still here? So I think they need more community-based planning. And you'll notice that in Pittsburgh, there were a few groups that felt like they were left on the outside. And so I think there is a sense of planning for the whole, but as long as we get most of them, it's okay. And I think that such a small... Pittsburgh has a relatively low percentage of minorities, that also takes away some of the power. Compared to previous years, the number has gone down. Mm-hmm. So that's an issue as well. So we're going to go over here, then back over here.
Yeah, I just had a question. I'm not sure if you mapped it, but it could be just more about your perception. But the partnership organizations that are not focused mainly on tech, mm-hmm. Do you feel like the cooperation versus competition picture is different? Or is it pretty much the same in the three cities?
Oh, no. In Pittsburgh, there's much more cooperation, much less competition. So, or new organizations that seem to evolve out of need. Like there was a hole in the system somewhere, as opposed to... they just developed this on the north side, now I'm going to put one here to compete with them. In Chicago, it was exactly that. They did it, but I'm going to do it better. So there were organizations turn over quickly because of that. But they were intending to directly compete, versus here, they were intending to kind of build together. That was very clear. Yes. Oh, wait. You, then you.
So I was thinking about capacity and experience for some of the leaders of these organizations. Did you find any sort of correlation between some of those lower experience, lower educated organizations and the type of support that they were giving to entrepreneurs versus some of those kind of high capacity models? I'm just thinking about professional development for the entrepreneurs to kind of raise the bar there.
What I saw is that when we had individuals as administrators of organizations who didn't have a lot of experience, they tended to use canned programs. They tended to use cookie cutter programs that they could just either buy or access. So basically they didn't have to think about it. Whereas some of the organizations run by people who knew entrepreneurship well tended to tailor their programs, design their own programs, and constantly change them, as opposed to one organization I'm thinking of was using a very old kind of canned entrepreneurial assistance program, which you really didn't have to know entrepreneurship to be able to run. And they have been using that for a while. So... that was the main difference that I saw. I'm losing track here. I think we're going here and then back over here.
So just as kind of a latest question, I'm not really sure what the extent of EAO is referred to. Are you from the financial institutions and legal firms, or is it just like universities, or is it just like little shops that give advice? I'm not really sure what that goes.
It's really broad. It's not really financial institutions, and it's mainly, it could be incubators, accelerators, community development corporations. It could be a private a privately run organization that assists entrepreneurs for fees. So I really intentionally made it broad because I really was focused on where you can get assistance as opposed to where they're coming from. But it does not include the financial institutions.
Earlier you showed a map of these entrepreneurial hubs mm-hmm. and defined walking distance as a mile and a half.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you took topography into consideration during that, because in Chicago, a mile and a half may be considered walking distance, but in Pittsburgh, I think there are some areas where a half a mile may not be considered walking distance.
Right, and I didn't. I used a mile and a half because in the access literature, it says a mile and a half is reasonable. There's some other data that you can use that will take into consideration, like paths that you can walk on, and also there's some others that can take into consideration transportation, access in terms of transportation. And, you know, I'll just say my GIS skills are not that high. I took GIS, I think when I was here in graduate school at CMU, it was the first GIS software coming out. That's what I learned. And
bad
so,
info.
Right.
Bad info.
Exactly. And I was hot stuff when I learned that.
Yeah, they were from Pittsburgh.
But, oh, were they?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. So I didn't do anything really sophisticated with this. And this wasn't even supposed to be a main part of the research. It's actually not in the paper. But I just wanted to see, like, a mile and a half, what it would look like. So I could do some more sophisticated analysis with that, but given the focus of the paper, I probably won't.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
Who was next?
Eddie, one last question.
Just
go ahead.
It seems like there's a lot of very important information, you know, of course, we think of for Pittsburgh. I mean, and I don't know that everybody's going to read the Economic Development Quarterly, you know. So do you, is your research being published in other ways, or do you, like, give something back to the people, you know, the community development folks that you interview? I just, you know, I think it would be helpful if, I mean, fortunately we're fairly collaborative here, but just even like the issue of where they're located,
mm-hmm.
You know, how can they get better access? Maybe it's not setting up a new building, but maybe it's having hours and, you know, another shop.
Well, I was just contacted by a foundation last week that said they would like to talk about breaking this up into white papers and publishing them online around different themes for each place. So we're scheduled to talk next week. So that may be a next thing that I do.
Okay, well, join me in thanking Elsie for her and it's great to hear all the questions and anything that comes out of the